Before I begin, I just want to thank you all for extending to me the honor, and I mean that seriously, the honor of speaking before you here today. It still seems incredible to me that anyone would be so willing, but then Unitarians, as I have discovered, are a remarkably generous and openly forbearing community. The trick is not to disappoint, to struggle to hallow that openness, to strive to provide something of use or meaning in return. Whether I'm able to do so or not, we shall see. But at least I want to thank you, one and all, for giving me the chance to try. Now, it's become my habit to begin each talk I do with a joke. I do this for two reasons. First, a good joke, publicly shared, has the effect of waking us up, of grounding us collectively in the moment, gathering us together, as it were, in a mood of alert mutuality and joy. The second reason I like starting with a joke is that it serves as an invitation not to take anything I might have to say too seriously. So here's this morning's joke. A guy goes to confession. He enters the box, kneels, and says, "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned." The priest, recognizing the fellow's voice, says, "Is that you, Tommy?" "Yes, Father, it is." "Well, what is it you have to confess, then?" "Well, Father, I've been with an unmarried woman." "Oh, dear, dear," says the priest. "Tell me now, who was the girl?" "I'm not sure I should say, Father. I don't want to ruin her reputation." "It's all right, my son. There are no secrets hid from God. So tell me, was it Fiona?" "No, Father, it wasn't." "Was it Anne?" "No, Father, it wasn't." "Was it Brenda, then?" "No, Father, it wasn't." "Well, I don't suppose it matters. Say, 5 Our Fathers and 4 Hail Marys." And with that, the fellow got up and went back to the pew where his friend had been waiting. "How'd it go?" his friend asked. "Pretty good," he replied. "Really? What'd you get?" "I got 5 Our Fathers, 4 Hail Marys, and 3 good leads." Now, my intention here this morning is to try to provide each of you with a few good leads of your own, albeit of a less recreationally physical nature. What exactly counts as a lead, however, what catches you, what you find meaningful or interesting, is for you to decide. As for myself, I propose simply to take us on a little thought journey, to shepherd us, as it were, on a short hike into the wilderness of the human imagination. I am, if I do my job properly, only an opportunity, a prompt to your own self-disclosure and self-discovery. Human beings, it has been suggested, are pattern-seeking, pattern-making creatures. It's a characteristic we share with other species, but which, due to the extraordinary development of our brains, crystallizes or flowers forth to a degree, so far as we are presently aware, unique in the world, perhaps even the whole of the cosmos itself. It is a quality I would describe as a kind of radiant wakefulness or alertness, reality itself become and becoming self-aware within each of us. We grasp and orient ourselves in the universe chiefly through the patterns we call stories. So crucial are stories and storying to our psychological or spiritual well-being that we can, in a sense, be considered composed of such. As the First Nation storyteller Thomas King put it in his 2007 Massey lecture, the truth about stories is that's all we are. The stories we tell ourselves, the stories we pass along and wrap ourselves within, are central, not incidental, to the experience and challenge of being human. And a person without some form of aspirationally symbolic interior patterning can never develop or flourish beyond the most minimal level. Now, there is a notion loose in the world, a notion present in some of our oldest and most popular stories, which I find immensely troubling. Variously put, it's the idea that we as creatures, as a species, and as human persons have lost our way, that we have so separated ourselves from the rhythms or structuring absolutes of nature, of reality, that we have become a kind of toxin or carcinogen within being itself. More worrisome still, this distancing dis-ease is thought to be not simply a matter of misstep or mistaken behavior, an aberration of some kind, but something far more basic, something coeval with being human itself. It's not a condition which can be cured or corrected or fixed. It's what we are. We can see the lineaments of this notion practically everywhere. In the biblical Abrahamic account of the fall in the garden, within the fixed pessimism of pre-Christian Greek tragedy and the declining ages of gold, silver, bronze, and iron, in the Icelandic and Norse sagas, and within the underlying assumptions, both ancient and modern, which dominate our politics, our economics, even our dismally violent entertainments. And it's not just found in the West. This condemnatory conception of the human is also present, I would suggest, within Taoism, Hinduism, and Buddhism, in the futility of the eternally cyclical nature of reality, of the false problematic self, and most especially in the ultimate goal of ego extinction or of self-annihilation, which has historically and popularly been understood as the highest or final end of enlightenment. The most recent embodiment of this tale of fallenness of human nature can be found in what has become the dominant narrative within environmentalism. As the philosopher Slavoj Žižek describes it, environmentalism has come to define or describe the non-human realm of nature as a stable and harmonious network of balanced relationships, into which we have in some sense been dropped, and which, due to our unnatural nature, we have recklessly and greedily despoiled. More than once, I have heard people wonder, or rather declaim, how much better the world would be had our kind never been born, a sentiment I find utterly heartbreaking. It's like a child imagining that its family would be better off if only they were dead and gone. The only hope, to the extent that such a thing is suggested, requires a turning away from ourselves, a submission, a repentance, a renunciation, an abandonment, a regression of sorts to a childish or childlike pre-fallen animal innocence, a yielding submersion back into either the enveloping, lobotomizing embrace of Mother Nature, or submission to the will of a divine, immaterial, and ultimately trans or non-human paternal abstract. This conviction is perfectly captured in the wording of the confession from the Anglican Book of Common Prayer, a confession weirdly in keeping with our global warming consumerist proliferation, as the change of a single word clearly illustrates. Almighty and most merciful Gaia, we have erred and strayed from thy ways like lost sheep. We have followed too much the devices and desires of our own hearts. We have offended against thy holy laws. We have left undone those things we ought to have done, and we have not done, and we have done those things we ought not to have done, and there is no health in us. The point, in whichever way one chooses to read or address it, is the same, that the goal, the good, the divine itself, is not to be found within the human, but without, somewhere else, in another time, another place, another reality. Being human is our sin. Well, I don't believe a word of it. Moreover, I believe that such views are based on a fundamental misunderstanding of the human being and what our appearance, our existence, portends as possible within nature itself. Far from our being a sign of despair, it is the mystery and the wonder of the emergence of the human being, more than anything I can name or number, which gives me hope for the world and the universe beyond. I think that what we are glimpsing within these stories of fallenness is in fact a critique of nature itself, which we have abusingly interjected in an attempt to cope with the hopelessness and despair engendered by an insight about the order and ordering of being, rather the way children so often come to blame themselves for their parents' marital or financial difficulties. Nature is not a benign, New Agey avatar-like love fest, a balanced arrangement of harmonious hugs and squeezes. It's a charnel house, an abattoir. It proceeds through sacrifice. It brings forth forms even as it consumes them, ingesting itself in an ever-burning movement of destructive creation. There's a marvelous Gary Larson cartoon which perfectly defines the situation. It's of a dinosaur looking at a calendar on which it has been crossing off the days. In each day's box is written an identical to-do list. Kill something and eat it. Kill something and eat it. Kill something and eat it. And so too with each of us, whether we choose to admit it or not. As Joseph Campbell used to like to say, a vegetarian is, in the end, simply someone who cannot hear a carrot scream. What is true for each individual is also true for everything within nature. As David Suzuki has pointed out, 99% of all the species that have ever lived have been extinguished. Extinction, not survival, let alone sustainability, is nature's way. The current human-generated planetary collapse is but one in a series of over 24 known extinction events, and destructive as it is, it's far from the worst. If plotted out on a chart, we would see nature proceeding along a kind of rising sawtooth line of proliferation and then collapse. Proliferation and then collapse. Our behavior is not an aberration from nature's ways, but a manifestation of them, completely in keeping with its previous history of self-destructive imperatives. In this regard, we are no different from the first photosynthesizers, who, after having reigned supreme for hundreds of millions of years, nearly poisoned themselves off in a vapor of toxic waste, a vapor of oxygen. Let me suggest an alternative way of perceiving our condition, our dilemma. The problem, if we can be said to have such a thing, is not that we have become separated out or alienated from the rhythms of nature, but rather that we are still too smotheringly embedded within them, still too captive to their hypnotic thrall. Our problem is not that we are human, but that we are not human enough. According to the ancient Indian practice and philosophy of Kundalini, the grounding energies within nature are three: the impulses to survival, procreation, and the will to power. These are the necessary drives which, upon which all life is based and from which it proceeds. As the sociobiologist Robert Wright has illustrated, they cannot be left to chance. We feel them within and are driven by them in moments of stress and crisis and arousal. Delicately minded people may demur, but the truth is none of us would be here if it weren't for the presence of these most basic energies. They are the oldest of the gods, but they are not all there is. They are foundational, but they are not final. Beyond the first three levels of breathing, breeding, and besting lies a fourth, the level of the heart. And when an individual awakens to and begins to practice this mode of being, there gradually emerges a radical transformation of consciousness and character. The energies and drives which had been directed against the outer world in order to satisfy the desires primarily of the individual begin to alter, turning inward against the drives themselves, sublimating and harnessing their energies in the service of others. Key to this is not, I would suggest, the extinguishing of the self, but the developmental expansion of the self to enlarge the circle of identification and concern, as the ethicist Peter Singer puts it, to such a degree that ideally and eventually it might embrace, given sufficient time and discipline, the whole of the world. Not idolatrously and narcissistically, as a child or an adolescent might, but in an attitude of fully mature, fully adult love. It is the birth of the humane being in what had been only a human animal. Until recently, and I suppose for much of humanity still, such a transformation of spirit or of being has been seen as the painfully heroic achievement of only a few very rare and gifted individuals. Yet, through the work of several of our greatest psychologists, among them Jung, Neumann, Maslow, Erickson, Fowler, and Graves, together with more recent psychological, anthropological, and scientific research into attachment theory, higher coping mechanisms, and even brain imaging studies, we are coming to realize that such a transformation is not the exception, but integrally potential in varying degrees across the species. We are, it seems, given a mysterious admixture of condition, biology, prodding, and will, morphologically or developmentally predisposed to become compassionate and kind, far beyond the pair bonding and group altruism operatively nascent in so many of our fellow creatures. Our capacity for cruelty and horror, a capacity we share with all of nature, gets most of our collective attention. But the secret unseen truth about us is that we contain and regularly, as a matter of course, exhibit and express so much superfluous good, so much decency and kindness. And that brings me back to those tales of our fallenness. It suddenly struck me recently that there is something deeply paradoxical about the darkly critical stories we hold about ourselves. If we truly believed we were as unredeemably awful as they seem to suggest, we wouldn't be telling them at all. They'd be as dull as dishwater. There'd be no point, no scandal, no outrage, no energy within. The horrific news of the world would fail to shock or even draw our attention. It really would be all we expect, so why bother? Instead, let me suggest that the very presence of such dark narratives and the shock and distress which they evoke in us point emphatically toward another intuition or insight altogether, to another story about ourselves. I think that we feel the way we do about ourselves because there is within each of us, at our most human core and center, the clear knowing that we are not this way at all, that we are and can be something inspiringly, almost inconceivably else. These stories are challenging us, daring us to prove them wrong. They're calling us out. They're calling us to love. This, I believe, is our gift and role within nature. We are the way in which the universe is struggling to grow up, to awaken and choose another way of being altogether, to tip the balance point, to learn finally to live in and through what the Buddhists call boundless compassion and what in the Christian tradition is called agape. It is not something beyond or alien to us. It is something inherent. It's something, if I can speak in such boldly teleological terms, it's something we are all meant to realize. It is our purpose. It's why we as human beings matter, and matter so vitally at this critical moment in our planet's history. The more I've been thinking about it, the more I've come to the conviction that the only thing that can save us now is love. We've tried everything else, and it hasn't worked. We must finally become the kind of persons we've always wished or dreamed we could be. As it says in the Gospel of Thomas, "If you bring forth what is within you will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you." Now is the time, and the chances have never been better. We've never been as broadly educated, as open, as aware, as interconnected as we are right now. And the deeper point isn't whether we succeed, though I see no reason why we can't. If we fail, we fail. And in the long run, the planet and the universe are no worse off than when the crabs ran amok in their own time. As Woody Allen says, if you're not failing every now and again, it's a sure sign you're not doing anything very innovative. The point is to try, and I say we give it a go. Thank you.